Welcome to the Governance Podcast from the Centre for the Study of Governance and Society here at King's College London. I'm Mark Pennington, the Director of the Centre. In November last year, we were very pleased to host Professor William Easterly to give a public lecture on paternalists versus liberals in economic development. Bill is Professor of Economics at New York University and is one of the world's leading authorities on the political economy of economic development. As well as numerous articles, he's the author of three highly regarded books, The Elusive Quest for Growth, The White Man's Burden, and The Tyranny of Experts. A central theme in these works is that development economists often claim to know more about how to promote economic development than is justified, and that the consequence of following their advice is often a combination of poor economic and social outcomes alongside threats to human freedom. I'm very pleased to have Bill as my guest on the Governance Podcast today. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay, Bill. So I mentioned in my introduction there that one of the key themes in certainly your works of the last 20 years has been this kind of skepticism about economic expertise, certainly in the developmental area. And I wanted to start by asking you, is this skepticism towards economic expertise something that you felt all the way through your career, or is it something that sort of emerged as a result of your own experiences in this field?
Yeah, I would say it's the second. It's something that was growing over time in reaction to my experiences at the World Bank with myself being a supposed development expert offering advice to poor countries where I was traveling for the World Bank.
So I guess that alludes to the subtitle of The Elusive Quest for Growth, if my memory serves me right, is Economists' Adventures and Misadventures in the Tropics.
Right.
Could you say a little bit about those adventures and misadventures?
Yeah, so when I joined the World Bank, I started going to Ghana in 1985, which I had lived in as a child, actually. And, you know, at that time, it was very noticeable how Ghana had been a disaster thanks to the kind of policies advocated by development people for a long time of emphasis on planning rather than markets. And then, you know, another formative experience was going to what was still the Soviet Union in 1990, which is not technically in the tropics, but,
yeah.
But it was also a kind of a shocking experience for me that, you know, when the first kind of day that I was in Moscow, I was like, wow, this really did not work. So everything is so shabby and dysfunctional and ugly and gray and dark. And that sort of, you know, made me wonder why development economists have been pushing the remedies that failed so catastrophically in Ghana and Soviet Union for so long. And, you know, why we were still trying things that themselves were not super successful at first. So in the 90s, the World Bank was pushing structural adjustment loans, which were trying to sort of force countries to do economic reforms. And they were not successful at achieving the desired economic reforms by doing that. And so the loans themselves could not be repaid because they hadn't generated anything productive. So the debt crisis of African countries in the 90s was kind of a reflection of that failure. And then the Soviet Union, as it transitioned to being a post-communist economy with the independence of Russia and other Soviet republics, that was not a great success either at first. The inflation was in the thousands of percent. The output was cratering by 30 or 40% decline. So it looked like not only did we not get the answers right with the previous generation of development economists who were advocating planning instead of markets, but we also didn't seem to know how to get out of planning and to have a transition to markets that would yield, you know, big economic gains. So that sort of like, you know, overwhelmingly negative experience is what kind of convinced me to change course and become a lot more skeptical and doubtful about the World Bank. And that's about when I left the World Bank, was 2001, because of that.
Yeah, I mean, this is something we can perhaps explore a little bit more in the conversation, but I think it's it's really important to stress that in your work, on the one hand, you have got this skepticism of, if you like, anti-market arguments, which are claiming that planning experts know better than people. But at the same time, you're also equally skeptical of a kind of pro-market expertise that believes that you can sort of just transplant market institutions into societies that don't currently have them. Or if they do have them, maybe they're in a very sort of distorted form. Right. So, I mean, I wouldn't say that this leads to a totally pessimistic view of the world, but it's certainly, I think, important to bring out that you're critical of both those forms of expertise.
Yes, that's definitely correct. And, you know, I mean, I think I sort of learned from that, from experience over time, also on the criticism of sort of pro-market experts. I think, you know, I was initially very critical of them in the 2001 book, The Elusive Quest for Growth. I think I've since been convinced that to be more kind to them than I was at that time. I think what they did get right, what the World Bank and the IMF and other pro-market experts at that time did get right, is just that these extreme distortions were catastrophic and had to be done away with as quickly as possible. You know, so inflation in the thousands of percent is always disastrous. You just want to get out of that as soon as possible. Yeah. You know, having a high black market premium on foreign exchange that makes it very hard for exporters to export, or have, you know, drastic price controls on export goods like Ghana had in the 1980s when I was first arriving there, you know, where the cocoa exporters were forced to turn in their goods at officially suppressed price level to the domestic cocoa marketing board, which gave them about 6% of the world price, and that had killed off cocoa exports in Ghana. So, you know, getting those things right, I think does have some clear benefits. And I think the pro-market experts did get that right. I mean, when Ghana indeed did start doing those reforms, when I was traveling there in the mid-1980s, Ghana did have a big growth turnaround. And since then, you know, the evidence I've seen is that there are kind of big growth turnarounds when you just get out of the extremes, so that you can get sort of some cheap, pretty predictable gains when you just get out of those extremes of extreme high inflation, extreme trade distortions, et cetera. But still, it still doesn't make it like an easy problem to just say, oh, you know, liberalize, privatize, stabilize, and the problem is solved. Everything is easy. You know, prosperity will arrive overnight. That's too easy. Like you said, if a society is lacking pro-market institutions, or if the politics are unfavorable, then it's not going to be so easy, even with pro-market reforms, to generate growth. And I think maybe the over-promising that happened with those who are doing pro-market reforms, especially in Latin America and Africa, I think hurt the cause of pro-market reforms.
And if you look at, you know, if you look at some of those institutions today, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, these kind of institutions, do you think that they've learned those lessons, or do you feel that they're, you know, so do you think the state of knowledge in that sense has improved over the last 25 years, or do you feel that there's a sort of new generation of mistakes being sort of developed by these institutions?
You know, I think they had learned them for a while, and you know, part of the problem was it's not so easy, even if you learn the lessons, to know what to do about them. Yeah. How can you, even if you understand that institutions are necessary, what do you do about seeing those good institutions arrive in any poor country that the experts are trying to diagnose a cure to poverty? So that it wasn't that they weren't learning. It was just that even if you learn, it's not so easy, and people really want the easy answers. Yeah. Then I think what's happened more recently is we've sort of forgotten some of the successes that we did have getting out of those extreme anti-market policies. And I think now, you know, with sort of all the skepticism about what is called neoliberalism, you know, the sort of retrospective dismissing of the Washington consensus, the set of pro-market policies that were agreed upon in Washington in the early 1990s, I think represents a kind of new wave of amnesia that there was success getting out of the extremes. And now we've forgotten that, and now the risk is, you know, countries will be drifting back into the extremes. I mean, Argentina went back into high inflation, Zimbabwe went back into high inflation.
Yeah.
And you know, that the sort of lesson, like, just don't do stupid stuff, you know, which I think was Obama's motto about foreign policy, which was of course not exactly adopted. Just don't do stupid stuff is kind of a very underrated recommendation in policy. And when you forget that, then you start drifting back into the stupid stuff, and you're sort of focusing on something that's more difficult. So the critique of neoliberalism is a lot about inequality, you know, rising inequality, which is an even more difficult problem to solve than just getting simple economic growth is. And I think that was sort of like an escalation, like you failed to solve the easiest problem, now let's escalate to a more difficult problem while neglecting and forgetting what we did to solve the easier problem.
Yeah.
That I think has been an unfortunate development in the current generation that's kind of in power in the World Bank and the IMF and the US Treasury under Biden. And you know, that's sort of an unfortunate setback.
And where do you think that is coming from? Is that coming from a new set of experts, or is that partly being driven by, you know, a lot of the kind of populist movements that are operating in various parts of the world at the moment that are kind of very skeptical of trade, skeptical of markets? It seems to me, my sense is it's partly coming from experts, but it's also these kind of more bottom-up forces or political forces that are pushing forward certain narratives that people in these institutions feel they have to respond to or give some kind of credit to in some sense. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's some combination of both, I think. Maybe a sort of like toxic interaction between some of the experts and some of the populist movements. If the experts say, you know, we want you to care about inequality as the main thing that we're you know, recommending. And, you know, so we expect you to vote for, you know, what the experts tell you you should be voting for, which is for the redistributionist policies. And when the working class fails to vote that way, then they say, well, you're too stupid to appreciate what's in your own material self-interest, you know. So the only cure is to just that we somehow finally educate you out of your own stupidity.
Yeah.
And you can understand why a populist movement would kind of make hay out of reacting to that kind of expertise that's, you know, calling the voters stupid is not a great formula for winning elections. And even when you have some of the atrocious candidates that populists have, they can win elections because they have an understandable revolt against the sort of condescension and insults of the experts that are identified mainly with kind of more left of center parties.
Yeah.
You know, this is a big narrative in the U.S., has been a big narrative in the U.S. for a long time. You know, there's sort of like, there's this book, What's the Matter with Kansas? You know, why isn't Kansas voting for the redistributionist policies that we think is in their own interest to address inequality? And Kansans apparently have different priorities than that. And, you know, it's not because they're stupid, it's because they have different priorities than that, or they don't believe that these policies are either what they want or are going to be effective in achieving the gains the experts think they will. You know, more recently, Paul Krugman wrote a column in sort of the same spirit just a few days ago. You know, what's wrong with rural white America that there's so much rage? And, you know, again, he almost came out and said explicitly, you know, they're too dumb to appreciate what their own self-interest. So they fall for the populist, the make America great again kind of narrative. And, you know, that explains why they don't vote for the Democratic Party that's offering these redistributionist solutions. Of course, the other theory is the one I just gave. They don't vote for people who call them stupid, which is, I think, a much more persuasive theory than the other
one. I mean, another example, I probably shouldn't single him out, but I'm actually going to. Another example of this is Joseph Stiglitz. He has a new book out, which is another assault on neoliberalism, in effect, by the look of it. But it's striking to me that, you know, it's only 15 years ago, He was advising Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and making public statements about how the Venezuelan model offered so much potential for the future. And yet when the model implodes, he doesn't actually appear and say, I got that wrong. He just goes off and attacks somebody else. And it seems to me experts from whichever side of the sort of political spectrum they're on, you know, when things go wrong, they should at least kind of fess up to the mistakes that they may have made.
Yeah, I was in a debate with Joe about this a few years ago. And, you know, to be fair to him, I think he wasn't really advocating, you know, you should do like extreme price controls that cause all good supply to dry up. You know, extreme inflation and all the other stuff. But I think, as you said, he was very sympathetic to a kind of democratic socialist ideology that seemed to be represented by Chavez and Maduro. And then maybe it was not clear enough in pointing out that the extremes were very destructive.
Yeah.
So that I think is what's, and the same thing I see in a much less extreme way, Danny Roderick, that is, you know, perpetually criticizing the neoliberalism. And the Washington Consensus and so on. I don't think Danny really thinks, and I've heard him say that, yes, extreme policies are very destructive and they destroy the economy.
Yeah.
But he doesn't spend enough time kind of pointing that out. This is what the pro-market crowd got right. And, you know, it really would be a lot better if Venezuela and Zimbabwe and Argentina were exiting from those extremes. And if you want to call that neoliberal, that should be okay, because getting out of that stuff is going to have huge benefits. And the anti-neoliberal people have just not made clear enough that's the situation in a number of countries.
Okay, well, I wonder if we can just change tack a little bit. So, you know, what we've been talking about so far, I guess, is some of these, you know, technical debates really within economics about what are good institutions. But when you gave your talk to us back in November, you actually looked at what I thought was as a different type of issue, although it's a related one, which was the importance of dignity in economic analysis. And you started your remarks off with, I thought, a very potent description of a young African woman entrepreneur feeling frustrated by the fact that whenever she spoke to certain Western sort of development theorists or actually even investors, that they were speaking to her as though she was a charity case that needed to be helped rather than as a sort of proactive agent. And that brought out in your discussion that economic development has got to be as much about dignity and the process through which people actually acquire development as it is about specific outcomes. I wonder if you could speak a little bit to that distinction.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something I've gotten a lot more interested in the last few years, in which I'm writing a book about now, sort of the history of development in ways that address, does development deliver dignity and not only material goods. And kind of the liberal, if we think of sort of the classical liberal tradition that goes back to Adam Smith, it was very much about, you know, seeing human beings as having a demand for not only material needs, but also a demand for agency, to be in control of their own destiny, to be able to consent to their own progress, to not be the passive object of someone else's plan for them without having the right to consent or reject what someone else is saying is good for them for their own development and progress. So this definitely goes back way into colonial times, when basically the colonizers were saying, you know, we think we can offer you a lot of material development if you're just willing to give up your right to agency, your right to consent. You know, we're going to force on you what we think is good for you, and if you're just willing to not complain too much about being forced, you will get great material gains. And that was pretty extreme in colonial times. Even there were theories of even benevolent slavery that, you know, people like Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill were fighting against very much. And that's sort of where this liberal tradition of stressing agency and dignity really got launched in those kind of battles. And certainly we don't have anything that extreme today in development, but it's still the sense that there's the sense that, you know, if we're sort of ruthlessly going to do anything and everything to give you better outcomes as far as, you know, greater prosperity and peace, then it doesn't sort of matter how we violate your dignity along the way. So you have some kind of semi-ridiculous examples of this that Magat Wade was reacting to, the woman you mentioned.
Yeah.
She was reacting to something that was happening just at the time she was writing that column that I quoted, which was there was a campaign to fight Ebola in West Africa. And to fight Ebola, this group of musicians that had done a kind of notorious concert back in 1984 about the Ethiopia famine, when they recorded this really insulting and pretty absurd song called Do They Know It's Christmas?
Yeah, I remember that very well.
Yeah, Do They Know It's Christmas? And so that, you know, generated a lot of furious reaction at the time of how insulting inaccurate and condescending that was, you know, just portraying Ethiopians and really all Africans just like famine victims with swollen bellies and children with flies on their eyes, which is on the picture of the Do They Know It's Christmas album. And there was some backing off of that kind of what was called poverty porn. And certainly not most aid agencies do not embrace that kind of extreme. But Magat Wade saw this happening over and over again. I mean, there was another wave of Do They Know It's Christmas and Band-Aid concerts around 2005, when there was a big campaign at the G8 summit to get more aid for Africa. And then when Ebola came along, these same musicians reissued Do They Know It's Christmas again, and, you know, had lines like there's hope and dread in West Africa and every kiss brings death, you know, referring to Ebola. And this made Magat Wade furious, because she was from Senegal, which had a grand total of one Ebola case. Ebola was super tragic for its victims, but not at all characteristic of all of Africa or even all of West Africa.
Yeah.
And, you know, when she's then trying to do her business negotiations with partners, you know, her partners are seeing her and you know, West Africans or all Africans as sort of like the kind of helpless victims that are portrayed in those songs. And, you know, is kind of amazed that she would be thinking about, you know, trying to launch a cosmetics company instead of, you know, just urgently soliciting charity for poor children dying of Ebola and famine and so on. And, you know, lots of Africans had that kind of furious reaction. You know, there was another Nigerian writer named Teju Cole who wrote something pretty impressive called The White Savior Industrial Complex, reflecting that kind of furious reaction to being insulted. So the message is that, you know, whenever you offer some kind of gain to the people you're supposedly helping and raising awareness about and soliciting donations for, you know, you're offering them the same kind of bargain that was not a bargain that was offered in colonial times. You know, let us take away your dignity in return for giving you kind of peace and prosperity. And a lot of people in Africa and elsewhere do not seem to be willing to take that deal. You know, they have been fighting furiously for two centuries for their right to self-determination, instead of, you know, instead of accepting this division of the world into, you know, the West and the rest, or the developed and developing, or those who are the givers and those who are the receivers. They want, you know, a kind of more fundamental moral equality, that everyone gets the same respect for dignity, the same right to choose in their own situations.
Yeah, well, I mean, just what you were saying there, I mean, and also I remember when I was listening to the talk that you gave, I mean, it sounded, and quite unusually actually, coming from someone who's an economist, the language you were using sounded very reminiscent of a lot of the arguments that post-colonial theorists make, which complain about even the whole discourse of development economics presupposes that there's this division between countries that have developed that will be exporting their institutions to those that have to be developed. And there's a kind of power hierarchy which assumes that there is this kind of superior wisdom that some people should accept from other parts of the world. And it was very unusual hearing an economist use that kind of language. And I wondered, is there something within economics that means it is resistant to that kind of thought? Does it see it as too ideological, not scientific? And if so, why do you think that is the case?
Yeah, well, so if someone is saying this is not scientific, they're completely correct. This is not scientific. Yeah. This is not a scientific debate. This is not about how to achieve better results on poverty. It's much more like a moral debate. Which I think is necessary for someone in development to have. I don't know if economists have the right specialization for that, but it is necessary for someone to kind of some or many people that are already challenging this, kind of challenging this assumption that anything in the name of development is sort of justified. So there's this sort of implicit moral assumption that anything that achieves moral development, I'm sorry, anything that achieves material development is sort of morally justified. That's the sort of implicit moral assumption. And then the challenge to that is to, well, wait a moment, that doesn't seem to be what people are happy with, that deal of having, you know, moral injury to themselves at the cost of getting better material outcomes. And this assumption that anything is justified in the name of development, that's been, you know, sort of overwhelmingly rejected over and over again in the history of the campaigns against colonialism and the slave trade, the campaigns against, you know, King Leopold's Congo, which was, you know, making the Congo prosper, but at the cost of forced labor and amputations of hands. And, you know, you think of this sort of anti-colonial movement as being like a pretty left-wing kind of anti-liberal movement, and that's largely correct. What's been forgotten is there was and still is a kind of liberal anti-colonial viewpoint. That the problem with colonialism was not that it was like, you know, something that the capitalists used to enrich themselves, which is somewhat true, but it's not the only thing going on. That's sort of the thing that the anti-colonial left is reacting against. But also colonialism was sort of violating liberal ideals by having, you know, sort of coercion instead of consent. You know, liberals hate coercion. By having paternalism instead of individual and collective self-determination. Liberals hate paternalism. And that by having inequality where some groups are denied the right to consent and the right to self-determination, while other groups are given have their rights respected for their ability to consent and self-determination. So this radical sort of inequality is also very much against liberal, you know, traditional liberal values. And, you know, one way to think about it is, you know, if you have an anti-liberal policy, then, you know, and it will often generate an anti-liberal reaction, but two anti-liberals do not make a liberal. You don't get to liberalism that way. But what you do need to recognize is if you have these long history of anti-liberal policies, you're creating a demand for dignity that will either be met in a anti-liberal way, which will be, you know, very bad for the people concerned and in the long run, or it can and could be met in a liberal way. And what, you know, I think what the liberals have offered throughout their history is trying to offer a liberal way to meet your demands for the right to consent and individual and collective self-determination and fundamental moral equality of all groups. And that's what economists, you know, not only Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, but a 20th century economist much identified with kind of libertarian values as Ludwig von Mises, who also was very vehement against colonialism. Isaiah Berlin, when he came along, was very, very critical of colonialism, very sensitive to this kind of demand for dignity by colonial, ex-colonial peoples, and how understanding that the colonial people might prefer an autocrat of their own group to an autocrat imposed on them by another group that claims to be superior to them. So that's sort of where we are now. I think we're by stressing only material outcomes, we're really losing the battle of ideas and values with the anti-liberal tyrants around the world.
Well, in a moment, I might try to connect this back to the earlier discussion about economics directly, but I wonder why is it that there are, certainly it strikes to me, relatively few economists, even those who are broadly within the liberal tradition, who are making the kind of arguments that you're putting forward. So, I mean, you gave very powerful remarks in your talk to us about the way Adam Smith at times made some very strong statements against colonialism. And you also mentioned just now von Mises also making strong anti-colonial arguments. But in general, people in the liberal tradition, if they're not pro-colonialist, they're not necessarily associated with anti-colonial arguments.
Right.
Do you have any thoughts on why that is the case?
I think maybe anti-colonialism has been captured so almost exclusively by the left that they sort of instinctively react against that.
Yeah.
And, you know, great liberal development economists like P.T. Bauer sort of had that problem, sort of failed to perceive the sort of injury to dignity that was happening with colonialism. Mm. And there's this temptation by liberals, you know, that you know that you need to have the institutions, as we were talking about earlier, to achieve, you know, a liberal market of prosperity. And, you know, so there's this temptation to think, oh, maybe the colonial governments could be very non-intrusive, except for just assuring, you know, sort of free trade and contract enforcement and so on. And that was sort of a liberal tradition throughout the history of liberalism. And, you know, and John Stuart Mill sort of had a weakness for that opinion also. And you can understand, you know, where that's coming from. But in the end, it's fundamentally destructive, I think, because it does fail to address this demand for dignity of equals that the liberals should be offering, instead of kind of trying to take a shortcut that would violate dignity and maybe make possible markets. But that shortcut is kind of self-destructive. It won't get you to kind of the liberal society that people think they will get to. You know, a sort of modern day version of this, it's sort of like the idea of chartered cities, which I'm somewhat sympathetic to. You know, you definitely want the idea of having kind of special economic zones where you try to have favorable conditions for exporting. That's fine. That was tried successfully in many places. That's okay. But maybe if you go too far in the charter cities direction, the idea that you sort of parachute in institutions that is somewhat, there's an element of coercion there, because you, to make the charter city work, you have to sort of take away the ability of the locals to consent or not to what's happening. And so you can see how it's, again, in a much more mild, modest way, sort of flirting with that colonial temptation of trying to parachute in the right institutions, thinking that will give you the market outcomes you want. And, you know, I think a lot of the liberal economists also, and I was like this during most of my career for sure, is, you know, we think our job is to comment on what's good for material prosperity. And that's a very successful discourse that we have had already and will continue to have. And we maybe correctly think that maybe that discourse is more persuasive than some kind of appeal to basic moral values would be in promoting liberalism.
I wonder if we can connect this issue of a dignity actually back to the idea of economics as a science. I mean, so, you know, you said before, well, this question about dignity is not a scientific matter. But I do wonder whether it can actually be separated out from what are considered to be scientific questions quite so straightforwardly. So again, something that came up in some of the remarks to you at the lecture that you gave was, think about something like the way economists discuss public goods problems. Mm-hmm. Or various other technical examples of what are considered to be market failures. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of logic to these arguments which says, in certain circumstances, we can leave it to people to engage in consensual relationships. Mm-hmm. But there are going to be others where there are certain technical conditions which mean that markets may fail. And hypothetically, at least, you could think of some situation where some kind of government agency or a technocratic agency could improve the outcome.
Yeah.
And you could see that as a purely technical or scientific discussion. But there is a kind of moral component to this as well, where people assume not only that this is the case, but there tends to be a sort of should argument that goes with this as well, that the government should intervene in these cases. And there's also an assumption, which is admittedly more of a kind of empirical one, that if you can identify these situations, then you don't assume that the people themselves who are subject to the problem can figure a way out of it. So they can't figure out their own way out of a public goods problem. They require an external agent, almost like a colonial master, to come in and solve the public goods problem for them. And, you know, that was one of the arguments that Eleanor Ostrom, for example, was responding against. The idea that just because you can identify a public goods problem doesn't mean you should assume that people can't figure a way out of it themselves. So I wonder whether there's something in the very logic of some of the sort of mainstream economic arguments that does actually lead to a form of paternalism, that the science, if you like, is itself not always respective of dignity.
Yeah, those are great questions. I mean, I think, yeah, it's very traditional in the economics that I was trained in, for sure, that you think of a market failure like the lack of a public good. You need coercion to supply that public good. And certainly that's a very compelling argument that's been, you know, around since Adam Smith also. Yep. Adam Smith clearly wanted, you know, policemen. You know, they did not envision a world of laissez-faire with no government coercion whatsoever. And I think it's be very rare to find anyone with any economist advocating zero government coercion. There's some recognition that there is needs for coercion. You can't have zero coercion. But then how do you find sort of the right amount of coercion? And who's to decide what is the right amount? So, you know, clearly, I think what's lacking here is this sort of sense, and to begin with, that there is something that people don't want coercion. You know, that coercion is sort of a violation for its own sake, that they have an aversion to coercion, with a rather lame rhyming phrase for that. And sort of the economist's argument focusing on sort of the material efficient functioning of markets is going to neglect that. It's going to not recognize that people might have a taste for an ability to consent. And certainly the right amount of coercion, we usually would think of that in a liberal society as being arrived at by some kind of democratic discussion with some constraints on the ability of the authorities to violate the personal rights of individuals in the society. And, you know, so in a sense, once you recognize the kind of taste for consent, but we know that's not the only thing going on. You know, we should also not jump to the assumption that sort of the consent versus coercion argument sort of trumps everything else. That's not true either. There's a demand both for kind of material prosperity and for consent and for freedom. And so what's going to happen is the society is going to engage in some kind of search for the right combination of those two things.
Yeah.
But then, you know, in the end of the day, what does it come down to? Is it the economist that's going to decide the right combination of freedom and you know, material prosperity? Or is it, you know, does the economist have any sort of special right or special expertise that would allow them to do that? I would say no. No, definitely not. That in itself is a matter for finding some kind of democratic way to get the consent of the citizens to reach the right amount of combining consent and material prosperity. And that may have happened during some kind of constitutional convention in which everyone agrees on the rules that constrain the government. They give a kind of bill of rights to citizens. We don't have like a simple, easy answer for how that happens, but the fundamental idea is this is not something that should be decided by the economists or by the experts. This is something that has to be part of a democratic process of consent.
Yeah, I mean, that seems quite persuasive to me. So I certainly take the argument that it's a kind of utopian fantasy to believe that you can completely rid the world of coercion, that everything can be based on purely voluntaristic contractual relationships. I guess the thing that I'm getting at is that there seems to be, I don't know, within economics for one reason or another, a somewhat of a bias. I mean, I guess some people would say economists are biased towards consent and towards markets. But my own feeling is that there's a bias towards finding reasons why you shouldn't rely on consent. So, I mean, I was very struck by again, going back to your lecture, there were very strong parallels between the kind of arguments that were being made by colonial authorities in the past to the kind of arguments that are made today by behavioral economics. That people, if only they knew what their true preferences are, if only they had the right willpower, would support certain things that would make them better off. We just need to do it for this to be revealed to people. And the structure of the argument is almost identical.
And so to give a very simple example, there's a study by Michael Kramer, the Nobel laureate who I admire a lot, and some co-authors that find that some people in I forget the African setting in which they were collecting this information, but they found this kind of strange unwillingness for women and other household workers who are gathering water for the household to sort of walk far enough to a clean spring, clean source of water, and that the I say women because it's usually women carrying the water. Women seem to be kind of irrationally going to a closer water source, which was contaminated and was trying to make them sick from contamination. And so it seems like there's, you know, this irrationality going on, and you need some kind of strong intervention to give some kind of some amount of coercion or a strong subsidy towards, you know, getting them to go to the farther clean water source. Of course, you know, I think we should be thinking like, maybe we're so arrogant that we think we know what the problem is, and we think, you know, because we think we understand it, we think we know it is the solution and can just kind of like impose a solution. When, you know, if we pause to think a moment, and I think if we had actually talked to some of the people involved, you know, you might become more aware of something like, well, there's severe constraints on time available for women in the household. They have lots of things they need to achieve at the same time, you know, care for the children, provide the food, provide the water, you know, work in the fields, you know, all the things that, and, you know, they just don't have time to achieve the perfect solution on in every area. And so, you know, it's not irrationality, it's just that we, the rational experts, are failing to appreciate what their problem is, what problem they're trying to solve. And this use that I just did in this sentence of saying we and they is itself kind of like a very much an echo of colonial paternalism, the world of we and they. It's we, the wise experts from developed countries who are telling them, the poor African women from a lump called developing countries, that we know the right answer and we're going to sort of force them to accept it. That's, you know, far more mild and should not be tarnished with the same brush as kind of the evils of colonialism, but still is a kind of mindset that has not completely rejected the kind of colonial mindset.
Well, I guess that's the case, isn't it, for what you were saying about it would be okay if people came in as part of a discussion where they were offering to people possibilities that they could select from, rather than something that is purely sort of imposed from outside. So it's about the framework within which these ideas are presented to people.
Very much so.
So are you actually working on a book which is actually developing these ideas, did you say, about sort of dignity and the role that this should play in I wonder if you could say a bit about that.
Yes, I have a second draft of the book. I'll be sending it in pretty soon to my publisher.
Okay.
And the tentative title is In the Name of Progress.
Okay, great. You know,
and again, the sort of theme of the book is, you know, don't think any and all actions are justified in the name of progress. Mm. You know, a lot of these actions are violating the sort of consent and dignity and self-determination and equality that liberals, you know, should have treasured. Mm. And so don't do immoral stuff in the name of progress. It's sort of the simple idea, you know, very simple idea. But I think there's like I'm going through lots and lots of concrete examples, you know, the theory of benevolent slavery, the early sort of development mission from 1787, the British sent to Sierra Leone in an attempt to kind of bring development to the African continent and also offer Black people from England kind of, basically part of this was there are Black people in England that were freed slaves that the British sort of wanted to get rid of and hoped to sort of kill two birds with one stone by sending them to Sierra Leone to start a kind of free labor colony that would, you know, also help bring development to the to Africans in Sierra Leone. And it was all sort of a moral and practical catastrophe when they tried to do this, but it did lead to kind of the foundation of colonialism in Sierra Leone. So just like one example out of a, after another, you know, the conquest of Native Americans in the U.S. in the name of the name of development, that we can the Europeans can develop the land better than they the Indians can, and we can even bring benefits to the Indians by you know, teaching them our great techniques and governmental institutions to bring them to a higher level of prosperity, but never sort of consulting them on whether they wanted to steal or not. So just sort of going over and over again throughout history of these examples. I mentioned King Leopold's Congo, sort of debate on colonialism after World War I, when Wilson sort of embraced the idea of kind of mandates in which the so-called civilized countries would kind of look over the former German colonies and guiding them to development, sort of reiterating the colonial idea of development over and over again.
Can we just pursue the Native American example actually just for a moment, because it's one I found really interesting. I mean, you put up again some really startling figures in your talk, which showed that if you looked at the narrative of the colonialists who were saying, you know, if we dispossess these people of their lands, this will actually result in benefits for them. Their incomes will go up, output will go up, all these sorts of things. And if you put up the statistics to show, well, actually looking at the ball statistics, that almost seems to be true, that Native American incomes, although they are considerably lower than those of the average US citizen, have increased dramatically since the period when their lands were removed from them. But the argument you're making is, at what price in terms of the dignity of those people? Now, I was very convinced by that argument, but I'm also wary of another sort of paternalism here, which is, I know from my own experience, once I went to, it's over 20 years ago, I went to the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, I think it is. And I was shocked by it. I mean, it is a very depressing atmosphere from my viewpoint. But at the same time, you know, what can I recommend to those people without then imposing my own projection on them again of, oh, this looks like a desperate place. You need some other form of deliverance to get you out from this, when it was that kind of saviorism that arguably was part of the problem in the first place. So how do we escape from this in a case like that?
Yeah, so, and I think the obvious thing to say is that there is no easy answer, and I'm not sure I or anyone else has any has a super constructive or easy answer. And sort of the lack of easy answer is sometimes used to kind of justify like not having this discussion at all.
Yeah.
You know, let's just forget up all that nonsense about, you know, the historical use of development to justify dispossession and conquest and colonialism. Let's just forget about all that. Let's just concentrate on the constructive things we can do today about world poverty. And I think that's probably where the vast majority of development economists would come out.
Yeah.
And then they would, you know, then send some kind of expert mission to the Pine Ridge Reservation and try to do the best possible to make those things better. And, you know, I can have a lot of sympathy for that viewpoint. But what is lost with that kind of compromise that you do? Let's forget about values and dignity and consent and just concentrate on the material stuff that we know we somewhat know what to do about. What gets lost is you keep having new violations of kind of rights and dignity when you have that mindset, you know, and the new violations themselves sometimes involve pretty obvious coercion, like military interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria and Libya, Somalia, you know, the list goes on and on, but Uganda, and sort of giving a lot of aid to our allies in the war on terror, which is strengthening authoritarian governments that routinely violate the rights and dignity of their own citizens. And we're sort of tolerating that in the name of, again, tolerating that in the name of progress, in the name of pure material progress. So just because those who advocate moral liberal rights don't have like an easy answer, that in itself does not allow you to kind of dismiss the debate on moral liberal rights.
Yeah.
You don't get it that easy just by saying, you know, you must have an answer or else we'll just dismiss all of this concern about dignity and freedom and go right back to it. Which is, you know, ironically, very much the same thing that was happening in previous rounds of Indian dispossession in the U.S.
Yeah.
You know, people were saying, well, let's, you know, forget about all this crap about land rights and all that. Let's just concentrate on teaching the Cherokees and the Creeks how to have peach orchards and, you know, grow corn and use our great techniques for doing that. That's going to be in their own material self-interest. But of course, that led to the Trail of Tears in the 1830s, which dispossessed the Creeks and the Cherokees and sent them into west of the Mississippi, into lands which they were taking from the yet other Indians, and, you know, having a bad outcome for, you know, decades after that. So the moral of the story is, you think you can escape the moral debate, but you really can't.
Yeah.
You just really cannot. We cannot have kind of unlimited justification of everything and anything in the name of progress.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very, very powerful point. So Bill, when is this book going to be ready? When are we expecting this to come out? I mean, it sounds like it's going to be a terrific read, like the other books.
Sorry, I'm choking out of a sort of I'm finding your question a little bit funny, because that's what all book authors get tormented by all the time. You know, when are you going to be done? When is your book going to be done?
Yeah, yeah.
Including my publisher, you know, very much as well. books always take a lot longer than you think they will.
Yeah. No, I'm just about to finish one myself. I thought it was going to take me 2 years to do it. It's ended up being 3 years. So I do know that feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, a lot of times people don't finish books at all. You know, that's, I know the people I've talked to who said, I have this book I'm working on, and sort of never happens.
Yeah.
At all. So I hope to stay ahead of that curve by at least finally finishing the book.
Well, whenever the book comes out, it's been great to talk to you. And thank you very much for giving the lecture to us. And yeah, I look forward to carrying on the conversation in the future. So thank you very much, Bill Easterly.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you very much.
Thank you.